with highs in the low 40s. Our winds continue from the west, gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Highs on Thursday in the mid 40s.
I don't think you can defeat despotism and totalitarianism if Democrats are regularly divided.
Tensions among Senate Democrats after a handful of them joined Republicans this week to try to end the government shutdown.
For Tuesday, November 11th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. 2 years ago, Colombia's president announced the country would stop extracting fossil fuels.
If we don't think about how to diversify the economy, if we don't think about how to reduce the dependency from oil, then we are going to be in trouble.
Also, Visa and MasterCard say they have reached a deal with businesses over swipe fees.
And Streganona, the beloved witch with a magical pasta pot, turns 50 years old.
She's a charming character, and I'm even amazed by her. She strikes a chord in everyone. You know, you don't have to be Italian to love Streganona.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The longest federal government shutdown in American history may soon come to an end. The House is expected to vote tomorrow on a deal to reopen the government, which President Trump says he'll sign, NPR's Sam Greenglass reports.
The House has not held any votes since well before the shutdown began 42 days ago. But after the Senate voted late Monday on a deal to reopen the government, House leadership called members back to Washington. The agreement funds most of the government through January 30th and select agencies through the end of next September, as well as guarantees back pay to federal workers and reverses firings carried out by the Trump administration while the government was closed. The deal also came with the promise of a Senate vote on the expiring Affordable Care Act health insurance subsidies, setting up a contentious debate on health care in the coming weeks. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
On a chilly Veterans Day, thousands turned out to the annual parade in New York City. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports from the noisy scene at Manhattan's Madison Square Park.
Amid spitting snow, veterans and service members and dignitaries and Girl and Boy Scouts marched down Fifth Avenue. Danny Prince is a veteran of the Navy, the Coast Guard, and the FDNY.
So much meaning from all the people that sacrificed so much to get us the freedom that we have and that we have right now. And people don't appreciate what we have. And it's so important to come out and thank them for what they did.
Parade marshals, including Medal of Honor recipient Clint Romesha and astronaut Sunita Williams, laid wreaths on a memorial statue in the park at 11:11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month, the date that commemorates the end of World War I. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, New York.
Baby formula maker ByHeart is recalling all of its products. The move comes amid an outbreak of infant botulism, a serious illness caused by a bacterial toxin. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Since August, at least 15 infants in at least 12 states have been hospitalized with botulism after consuming ByHeart's infant formula. No deaths have been reported. The voluntary recall includes ByHeart's whole nutrition infant formula and its anywhere pouches of powdered formula. Over the weekend, ByHeart had announced it was recalling two lots of its infant formula. On Tuesday, the company said its decision to expand the recall to all of its products came amid an ongoing investigation with, quote, too many unanswered questions. It said the safety of infants is its biggest priority. ByHeart says all of its products should be discarded. The company says it's collaborating closely with the Food and Drug Administration. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Leaders from the Group of Seven industrialized democracies are converging on Ontario as tensions rise between the U.S. and allies like Canada over defense and trade. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The British government is defending the BBC as it faces a dispute with President Trump. Trump is threatening to sue the broadcaster over how it edited a speech he made after losing the 2020 election. Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy says the national broadcaster faces, quote, challenges some of its own making, but is a trusted source of news and essential to the country. Rural Marion County, Kansas, will pay a total of $3 million to settle a lawsuit over the county's role in a small-town newspaper raid that made national news, as Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
In the summer of 2023, Marion, Kansas's entire five-member police force and two sheriff's deputies stormed the town's newspaper office and the publisher's home, confronting the publisher's 98-year-old mother, who had a heart attack and died the next day. The officers seized computers and cell phones, looking for evidence that the paper had improperly obtained confirmation of a local business owner's drunk driving conviction. It hadn't. The $3 million payment will be split between the publisher, two reporters, and the town's former vice mayor, whose home was also raided. The agreement does not clear the police chief of criminal charges for allegedly obstructing an investigation of the raids or the city's liability in approving them. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
The NFL has seen a surge in international interest, with 700,000 people trying to get tickets to watch the Miami Dolphins play the Washington Commanders on Sunday in Spain. This follows high demand for games in other cities like Dublin this year. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 5:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Bemidji Community Theater presents Anne of Green Gables, the musical, November 14th through the 23rd. Find tickets and showtimes at bemidjicommunitytheater.com. More news is next on People Powered KAXE.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Senate approved legislation to reopen the government last night. The House is expected to vote on the package as early as tomorrow evening. But most Democrats are criticizing the deal for not delivering on their key demand, the renewal of expiring health care subsidies. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hi, Deirdre.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so for weeks now, we've been hearing about what the Democrats have been demanding, and that is they would not back a funding bill unless it included a plan to preserve these health care subsidies for the millions of people who rely on them. So what exactly changed when a group of Democrats got on board with Senate Republicans?
Well, the talks about how to address these health care subsidies really started on the first day of the shutdown. That's according to New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen, who was part of this small group of moderate Democrats who negotiated this deal. Mm-hmm. But she told me and other reporters that the one thing that didn't change over the last 6 weeks was that Republicans were not changing their position at all, that they weren't going to negotiate on health care until the government reopened. She said yesterday the pain of federal workers not getting paid, people not receiving food assistance, was only going to get worse, and they needed an off-ramp. She was one of seven Democrats and one independent to join Republicans to vote for this deal that funds some programs through the end of January, includes some full-year funding for programs like SNAP and veterans benefits, and reverses the layoffs of federal workers.
All right, yes, but what about health care? Like, what exactly did these Democrats get then?
Not much. I mean, they got a commitment for a Senate vote by mid-December on a bill that they will write. Shaheen said she negotiated that directly with Senate Majority Leader John Thune. But there's no guarantee, even if the Senate could pass something, that the House Speaker Mike Johnson would put that on the House floor. But Shaheen says the White House was part of these discussions, and she pointed out that people in red states rely on these tax credits more than people in blue states.
I think the president is going to engage, and if he isn't, well, shame on him. He says he's going to help, even though he hasn't to date, but he says he's going to address affordability. Well, this is one of the big issues that are facing people in terms of affordability.
Yeah, but the majority of Senate Democrats voted no, so I imagine a majority of Senate Democrats are not thrilled with this deal, right?
Not at all. I mean, they are calling it a mistake. A lot of them are saying it undercuts the Democratic Party, which was mostly united over the course of the shutdown about making this fight all about health care. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy said the message coming out of last week's off-year elections, where Democrats had some big wins in governor's races, was that voters wanted the party to stick together. And he even said that President Trump admitted the shutdown was hurting the GOP.
This is a very, very hard moment. I am angry about how this went down.
The top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, voted no on this deal, but there are still growing calls from some House Democrats, from Democrats running in Senate Democratic primaries, for Schumer to step down from his leadership post. He was looped in on these talks, but they criticize him for not holding the party together.
So what do you expect to see when the House votes on this package? Like, do you think any Democrats will back it?
I think there'll be a small number, but top House Democratic leaders are urging their party to stick together and vote no, force Republicans in the House to pass it without any real help from Democrats. It is expected to pass sometime tomorrow night, which could end pretty soon the longest shutdown in American history.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you, Deirdre.
Thanks, Elsa.
Visa and MasterCard say they have reached a settlement to resolve a long-running battle over swipe fees. These are the fees that restaurants and retailers pay the card companies every time a customer pays with plastic. The fees are pennies on the dollar of any particular transaction, but they add up to big bucks. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, good to be with you.
Most of us don't think much about this when we pull out a credit card to buy, you know, incredibly small amounts of things these days, like $1.50, put it on your credit card. What's going on behind the scenes?
Well, every time you swipe your credit card at the coffee shop or the gas station, a little bit of that purchase price goes to the bank that issued the card and to Visa and MasterCard, which maintain the payment network. On average, that swipe fee is about 2.33%. And maybe that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but you multiply it by all those transactions and it adds up. You know, last year, businesses paid well over $100 billion in credit card swipe fees. For many businesses, these fees have become a major expense, especially since the pandemic when more people started using credit cards for those small purchases. A couple years ago, I talked to Victor Garcia about the ice cream shops he runs in Fort Worth, Texas. His customers had gone from mostly paying with cash to mostly paying with credit cards, and his swipe fees had ballooned as a result.
Most are shocked. Half of them say, my gosh, I have no cash. I wish I did. People don't know. They just say, hey, I get points, so I'm going to use my card.
So what would the settlement do?
It's designed to resolve a 20-year-old lawsuit that accused the credit card companies of anti-competitive behavior. Now, there's no guarantee it's going to do that. An earlier settlement proposal failed to pass muster with the court. But even if it does resolve the legal battle, this deal is not going to settle the larger economic dispute. Trade groups representing retailers and restaurants say the proposal doesn't go nearly far enough. It would reduce the average swipe fee, but only by a little bit, and it would give retailers a little more flexibility to accept some credit cards while rejecting others.
But why would they want that?
Well, different cards charge different swipe fees. And a big reason for that is rewards. Maybe you've got a card that gives you cash back or airline miles or other perks when you use it. The way that card companies pay for those rewards is partly by raising their swipe fees.
Oh.
So the fee on a fancy rewards card might be twice what it is on an average card. So in other words, when you're cashing in those rewards, the businesses you patronize are having to pay more for it and possibly passing that cost along in the form of higher prices to everybody else. The settlement would allow merchants to turn down some costly credit cards, but there's a real question how workable that is. I mean, is a restaurant or a retailer really going to tell a customer, we don't take that card and possibly give up a sale?
What other options do they have?
Well, some businesses do now add a surcharge for customers who pay with a credit card. They might encourage customers to use their debit card instead. The swipe fees are regulated on debit cards, and so they're a lot lower. Some lawmakers are pushing a bill to encourage more competition on credit card swipe fees, although so far card companies have managed to fight that off. I recently got my car repaired, and because I knew about these swipe fees, I offered to pay my mechanic with an old-fashioned paper check. He doesn't ordinarily take checks, but he did take mine, he said, to avoid the swipe fee.
NPR Scott Horsley, a correspondent with High Value Rewards Points. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
This week, world leaders are in Brazil for the annual UN Climate Conference to talk about how to cut planet heating emissions. Scientists say a key way is for some fossil fuel producing countries to stop exploring for new fossil fuels. One country's government decided to do just that, Colombia. NPR's Julia Simon went there to learn more.
In a fishing village on Colombia's Caribbean coast, music plays in cafes lining the beach.
It is cooler by the sea where the wind blows through the trees.
Out past the fishing boats, out in the turquoise sea, oil companies found deep water natural gas and plan to drill gas wells there. Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, wants those wells to be among the country's last. Colombia is the biggest coal producer in South America and one of the region's largest oil producers. And President Petro is one of the world's most outspoken leaders on climate change. 2 years ago at the UN climate conference, Petro took the stage and said this.
Colombia ha dejado de firmar contratos de exploración de carbón, petróleo y gas.
Colombia, he says, has stopped signing exploration contracts for coal, oil, and gas. This was a big deal. Stopping new exploration for fossil fuels is a key way to transition away from fossil fuels. Now the question is, how is Colombia's energy transition playing out?
Hola, so estoy grabando aquí.
Okay. To find out, I went to a leafy neighborhood in central Bogota and the high-rise office of Colombia's national oil company, Ecopetrol. There, I met
Julian Lemos,
corporate vice president of strategy and new business. Lemos says the oil company is diversifying. Ecopetrol has acquired an electricity transmission company, more solar and wind projects, and they're investing in geothermal, drilling deep into the earth to create electricity.
The hydrocarbon business will remain as part of our company, but we will gradually increase the participation of businesses that are not related to crude oil, such as renewable power transmission.
Energy experts say this isn't just a good move for the climate, it's a good move for Colombia's economy. Colombia has manufacturing, tourism, and agriculture, but the government is still very reliant on the oil and coal sectors for revenues. Ana Carolina González Espinosa at the nonprofit Natural Resource Governance Institute says as Colombia's oil reserves shrink and demand for oil and coal eventually fall, that will be a problem.
If we don't think about how to diversify the economy, then we are going to be in trouble.
Key to diversifying the energy sector is solar and wind. Solar, in particular, is growing, both large-scale and small-scale projects for communities lacking electricity. But the sector has problems, too. In some parts of Colombia, the grid still isn't big enough to handle all the new solar and wind. Many projects are on land belonging to indigenous communities. The government and private sector still haven't done enough to involve them in planning, says Margarita Nieves, a renewable energy researcher. She says some renewable developers have left.
Each project has its own challenges.
Petro's term ends in 2026, and that raises another question. Will his energy policies outlast him? Petro's government hasn't awarded new licenses to explore for fossil fuels, but this isn't signed into law. A new right-wing government could change gears and bring in more companies to explore for coal, oil, and gas. So, is Colombia's energy transition story a happy one? González Espinosa has thoughts.
It is not a happy story. It is not a sad story. It's just a real story.
Julia Simon, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXE, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXE.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
It's 5:19. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock tonight, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 20s, breezy west winds up to 20 miles per hour. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low 40s, and those west winds will continue. Looking ahead to Thursday, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s, and west winds around 5 miles per hour. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on KAXC.
For NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Let's go way back to September 23rd. That's when Democrat Adelita Grijalva won a special election to replace her late father in Congress, representing an Arizona district that borders Mexico. 7 weeks later, she has still not been sworn in to start that work. Now, with the end of the government shutdown in sight, House Speaker Mike Johnson says one of the first orders of business when the House is back in session will be swearing Grijalva in. Representative-elect Grijalva joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
How much time have you been spending in Washington during the past 7 weeks?
I've gone back and forth four times. And every time thinking that, you know, I could get sworn in during a pro forma session, mm-hmm. But that hasn't happened. And so four different times, a couple days each time, and then I came back to district.
How confident are you at this point in time that you'll be sworn in tomorrow?
I'm 90%? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been waiting for 49 days, so tomorrow will be 50 days. And several times during that period of time, we thought we were going to get sworn in. And so I do think we're closer to certainty than we have been in the past.
Have you had direct conversations with the House Speaker's office about this?
No, the Speaker's office has never communicated with me directly.
Interesting. Now, mm-hmm. let's talk about one of the reasons why you may not have been sworn in on the campaign trail. You promised to sign a bipartisan petition to force a House vote to release the Epstein files. Your signature would be decisive. It would compel a vote. Speaker Johnson has called the idea that the delay in swearing you in, the idea that it's related to that partisan manufactured thing. What is your understanding of the situation?
No, I do believe that there is absolutely a connection with me pledging to be the 218th signature on the discharge petition to release the Epstein files. And that has resulted in denying representation to more than 800,000 Arizonans for the last 7 weeks.
Is that something you still plan to do, sign that petition as quickly as you can?
Absolutely.
What do you hope releasing those files would achieve?
Justice for the survivors. And consequences for those who committed crimes against children and women.
Mm-hmm. What are your other priorities once you become an actual representative after this long way?
You mean what people actually elected me to do?
You put it that way?
The people in our district really want me to fight for our democracy, for immigration rights, for tribal sovereignty, for environmental justice. Mm-hmm. And for public education, and our economy, these are the issues that are so important to our community. Arizona, the 7th District, shares the 3 ports of entry with Mexico. It's a very diverse community with rural spots and urban, you know, centers. And all of the needs are very diverse and different, mm-hmm. very similar to our nation.
You're going to be one of your first votes, if not your first vote, will be on a big issue, possibly ending the federal government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Which way are you going to vote on that? Are you going to vote to reopen the government, or are you going to vote with most House Democrats to keep it closed?
You know, the reason why we're closed has nothing to do with, we shouldn't be closed at all. I was elected 5 days before the shutdown, and we should have consistently been working to negotiate a solution.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we've been closed this long is absolutely the fault of Republicans and leadership here. But I will not be voting for that continuing resolution. It has a lot of hidden benefits to specifically senators in relating to, I mean, enriching themselves. It does nothing for affordability for the American people when it comes to healthcare and continues to cut people out.
So you're a no on that particular vote. What did you think of the concessions the handful of Senate Democrats were able to get to vote yes?
They weren't significant in making a difference for anybody who's fighting to keep their health care. In Arizona, I spoke to a mom whose monthly bill to insure her and her three children was $500 a month. Her new bill is $2,400 a month. She will not be able to insure her or her family with that kind of cost. And what concessions were made were negligible when it is in relation to the problem that we have.
We've got about 30 seconds left. I want to squeeze in one more quick question. You've said you've been to D.C. four times. What have the conversations been like with other members of Congress?
Very supportive, very frustrated, advocating to swear me in because there's a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. That is Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva waiting to be sworn in as the newest member of the House. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Today, we remember a witness to a key moment in American history. John Cleary has died at the age of 74, but he is best known for speaking up about an event in 1970 when he was 19 years old and a college freshman at Kent State University in Ohio.
Most of the people in my major, we were basically just concentrating on getting our homework done and helping one another.
He was an architecture student with a heavy course load.
To be honest, the politics really didn't come up.
That's what he told an oral historian at Kent State in 2010. Back in the spring of 1970, President Nixon announced an expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia. In May, anti-war protesters set a campus ROTC building on fire. And the governor of Ohio sent over 100 National Guard troops to Kent State.
A large campus protest took place on Monday, May 4th. National Guardsmen tried to disperse protesters with tear gas. Between classes, John Cleary went to take photos.
I wanted to get one last picture of them before they went over the crest of the hill. So I was kind of getting my camera, I was winding it, getting ready to take another shot. And suddenly they just turned and fired.
The troops opened fire, and Cleary was shot in the chest.
I guess the best way I can describe it is it's like getting hit in the chest with a sledgehammer. It just really knocked me down.
Four students were killed. Cleary was one of nine injured that day. A photo of him laying wounded on a hill made the cover of Life magazine. It became a defining image of the Vietnam era, and it partially inspired Neil Young's protest song, Ohio, recorded with his band Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
John Cleary eventually recovered, graduated, and built a career as an architect. But for a long time after the May 4th shooting, he avoided speaking about it. That changed when his son was born on a May 4th.
And I felt like God was telling me something. You know, you can't bury this. You can't pretend it didn't happen to you. You can't put it behind you. It's something that you need to confront.
That's Cleary speaking to an oral historian at SUNY Binghamton in 2022. He gave similar interviews to historians and journalists, attended memorials on campus, and spoke to students, reconnecting with other survivors. He became a prominent voice, urging people to remember so that it didn't happen again.
At this year's May 4th commemoration at Kent State, John Cleary was chosen to ring a bell on campus to honor the victims. After a long illness, Cleary died in late October.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 529. Thanks for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Happy Dancing Turtle has a holiday and seasonal decor swap this Saturday, 9 to noon, at their office in Pine River. Items may include lights, tablecloths, gift wrap, and other decorations. If you would like to drop off items, you may do that this Thursday from noon to 6 or on Friday from 8 to noon. You do not need to donate items to take items.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The following story contains details that may be disturbing for some listeners. The Minnesota Court of Appeals has reversed a decision by Lake County District Court to deny an order for protection in a case involving alleged sexual extortion. The appeals court opinion states the lower court clearly erred in its findings of fact about the credibility of the alleged victim's testimony. A concurring opinion from Judge Japal Harris describes the findings as, quote, consistent with several sexual assault myths. The case involves a 2024 order for protection sought by a woman against her ex-husband, who was allowing her to live with him in Silver Bay after their divorce when she needed a place to live. In filing the order, the woman said she believed she would lose her housing if she did not agree to multiple instances of sexual contact with her ex. The district court ultimately determined the ex-husband's testimony describing the encounters as consensual to be more credible. The denial stated the woman was less credible because, among other findings, she never called the police, never reported it to friends, and talked nicely about the ex on social media. The appeals court, however, notes she did report the matter to police, the social media post was misinterpreted, and the other stated reasons were not supported by evidence. The matter drew the attention of Standpoint, a St. Paul organization of attorneys and advocates against domestic and sexual violence, which filed an amicus brief. Judge Harris writes, quote, if this is allowed to stand, we risk that people who most need the protection of the court may choose to not seek this protection for fear of being subjected to these archaic myths. The appeals court did not weigh in on whether the facts of this particular case support an order for protection and remanded it back to the district court for further consideration, but the lower court is not permitted to rely on any of its original findings. The Minnesota Department of Health has submitted an application to the federal government for participation in the Rural Health Transformation Program. The application seeks $1 billion in funding over 5 years from the program, which was created by the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. It aims to improve health outcomes and expand access to health care along with the workforce. Proposals include creating new opportunities for health screenings, using telehealth for preventive care and chronic disease management, and increasing the use of community-based frontline workers. It would also aim to strengthen the financial health of rural health care providers. The Minnesota Star Tribune reports the program would not offset the much bigger financial losses expected by looming cuts to the federal Medicaid program. The state will be notified by the end of the year if its application has been approved. Attorney General Keith Ellison will be in northern Minnesota this week as part of his series of Protecting Minnesota Community Forums. Ellison will discuss his work to, quote, protect the rights and freedoms of the people of Minnesota at the events. People can also share their stories or concerns. Events are scheduled for 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday in Grand Rapids, 1 to 3 p.m. Thursday in Ely, and 6 to 7:30 p.m. in Hibbing on Thursday night. An earlier event on Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. in Grand Rapids will focus specifically on veterans. People can RSVP to the events to receive location information. Find more info at kaxe.org. Dozens of Northland athletes from 9 area schools will compete at the state swimming and diving meet this week. Megan Buffington has more.
Brainerd's 200 and 400 freestyle relays will return to the state meet after finishing second and sixth last year. Three of the four swimmers on each team will be racing again this year. Senior Avery Durr is part of both relays and will also be swimming the 100 breaststroke. She finished eighth in the event last season. Northern Minnesota's other returning medalist is Two Harbors senior Bella Imholt. In 2024, she took sixth in the 200 freestyle and seventh in the 100 backstroke. She'll race in both events again and the 400 freestyle relay. Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Park Rapids, Rock Ridge, Mesabi East, and Detroit Lakes all qualified at least one individual entry and a relay team. You can find the full list of qualifiers at kaxe.org. Diving preliminaries kick off the state meet on Thursday. Swimming prelims will follow on Friday, with all finals on Saturday. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Sometimes we bring you news of stories as they're breaking, and other times pieces of journalism take time. NPR Veterans correspondent Quill Lawrence has spent the past decade following the story of one man, a combat veteran named Dave Carlson. Carlson is the subject of the new NPR podcast, Carlson's War. In this excerpt, the year is 2005, and Carlson, who had a felony record as a juvenile, had just enlisted in the National Guard. Quill Lawrence picks up the story.
So Carlson joined the National Guard, and he went to basic training, and he said it felt good. It felt right.
I was like, I'm good at this. Like, I can do this, and I feel something like, I feel a type of, like, purpose with this.
By the time he's ready to deploy, it's becoming clear, with the U.S. surging troops into Iraq and Afghanistan, that National Guard units are going to be doing extended combat tours.
National Guard and Army Reserve troops in Iraq will be staying a bit longer. Active duty troops are already being held longer than expected. Now Guard and Reserve troops are having their tours of duty extended to as long as a year.
This is just a couple years after 9/11, and all of the recruiting zeal and people signing up in big numbers after that is running into the reality that Iraq is not going to be a quick or easy war. And now guardsmen basically have to leave their jobs and spend a year in combat. And that was the case with Dave Carlson. He was told at the time he signed up that he was headed for war. He went on his first tour of duty to Iraq at the end of 2004. And it's just as the Iraq war is starting to get really nasty. He was sent to a base near a town called Diluwiyah. And the name of that town actually just sends chills down my spine because I was in Iraq at that same time and I know just how much violence and how much killing was going on in that town around that time. So Carlson's National Guard unit was mostly standing watch back at the base rather than going out on patrols. But Dave Carlson, he wants to do more and he wants to be out there where the fighting is happening. And he'll go out on patrol with anyone who'll take him.
I bounce around different squads, like sections going out depending on like my schedule, because I would pull like guard duty for like 8 hours or 10 hours, and then I would go on mission with them, or I'd get dropped off after mission, and then I'd go on guard duty.
Eventually, he started going out on missions with one particular platoon led by an Army sergeant named Alwyn Cash, who will later be recognized as one of the heroes of the entire Iraq War. But at the time, he was just the sergeant that Carlson had to pester about going out on patrols.
I was super nervous. I was a private. I was like a PV2, right? Super nervous to approach this individual. And I'm like, can I come with you on tour? Like my snot nose, like, and he put up with it, right?
And sometimes he'd wake up, like Cash was asleep from having been out on patrol all night. And he'd be like, Carlson, yeah, okay, yeah, just, yeah, whatever. Yeah, you can come on patrol with us. Just let me sleep.
And they would talk, like the other privates and stuff would talk and be like, well, you want to come out with us.
But Carlson did well out there.
But then a couple of the specialists and then maybe like one of the E5s came up to me and was like, why did you join the Guard?
That was meant as a backhanded compliment. They're asking Carlson basically, why'd you join the Guard? Why aren't you in the Army? And it felt really good.
I've felt like my entire life to anybody that accepts me, right? I just get like a fierce loyalty to them. And so that was, yeah, it was like the best thing in the world.
You know, he felt like he'd found his place and maybe he'd found his new family. And then it's toward the end of that year-long deployment. And Dave Carlson, he's on base and Cash's platoon calls his National Guard commander asking if they can have Carlson for the next patrol.
He was just like, I'm not letting you guys go on missions anymore.
Basically, he hears his National Guard commander say, you know what? No, we've been here for a year. I want to bring all my guys home and we're just not going to send them out on any more of these patrols. Now, honestly, to you or me, great call, right? You want to bring all your guys home. Who can argue with that? Well, Dave Carlson can.
Even though we've been doing this all year, for you to make it home and be able to like say that you brought everybody home, like you're willing to like deprive this other company of a resource that they may need.
In other words, to him, it was like saying, let's not do that. Let's let those other guys do that. Let's let Cash go out and do that. And all these other guys that he's starting to feel a loyalty to, guys he's been under fire with, let's let them go out. And this is another really crazy, cruel turn of fate. You know, I'm not sure if it was on that day that call came through that they said, no, I'm not sending any more guard out. But it was definitely within those couple of weeks. It was October 17th, 2005. Sergeant Alwin Cash and his platoon get ambushed.
Cash lived for like 2 weeks. Like 90% of his body had third-degree burns on it.
During this attack, the explosion, somehow, you know, Cash's uniform gets covered with diesel fuel. But he's going back into his burning vehicle to get his men out. And then Cash catches fire. He's on fire. And he goes back in several times. He gets seven of his men out of this vehicle while they're getting shot at. And then he refuses to get on the medevac until all his men are out. He gets on last, and he doesn't die of his wounds till over 3 weeks later at an Army hospital in Texas. Years later, he'll be recognized with the Medal of Honor, one of only 8 people to receive the Medal of Honor in the whole Iraq War. It's the military's highest medal. You get it for doing things that no one could ever reasonably ask of even a fellow soldier. Cash was the only black man to get this medal since Vietnam, by the way. But that's all years down the road. Right at that moment, all it means to Dave Carlson is, I should have been there. Like, why wasn't I there? Why did those guys die? Why did I survive? And those questions, they still haunt Dave Carlson even all these years later when he retells the story.
Bakum was an interpreter, their interpreter for the ECP, burned to death.
Take a minute, don't worry about it.
I'm good.
Yeah, take a couple deep breaths, whatever, have a sip, something. You never know when that stuff's gonna hit.
Yeah. I think this water.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
We're having this conversation almost 20 years after these men die. But I can see for a moment he's back in that place in Diluia, Iraq. And at the time, Carlson says he was just supposed to move on. By November 2005, his tour is over and he goes back to Wisconsin. You know, the active duty army, they come home and they're still in the army. They're supposed to have some dwell time before they deploy again. They might do a military job back here in the States. They stay with their same unit. When you're in the Guard, like Dave Carlson, everyone scatters back to their towns and cities and goes back to their day job. And they're just back on the streets of the USA. When you came home, are you just...
Home.
You're done. You're basically...
1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year.
And you're going to school.
Yeah.
So it's like you're a civilian suddenly.
Right back to being a civilian. It was bizarre.
Dave Carlson's story continues in our podcast. It's called Carlson's War, and you can find both episodes in the Up First feed or at npr.org.
This is NPR News. The FDA is removing warning labels from estrogen products that are used to treat menopause. The agency says that the warnings about increased risks of heart attacks, strokes, blood clots, and breast cancer are outdated and misleading. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
For years, women have heard mostly about the risks of hormone therapy, and many doctors have been hesitant to prescribe it because of the FDA's black box warnings. But menopause experts say it's now clear that there are safe combinations and doses. Here's Dr. Joanne Pinkerton of the University of Virginia.
If you're under age 60 or within 10 years of menopause onset, when you start hormone therapy, you're going to see improvements in hot flushes, sweats, fewer sleep disruptions.
As well as protections against bone loss and fractures, and potential benefits for heart health, brain fog, and quality of life.
Hormone therapy, when it's dosed appropriately, can be given safely and have multiple benefits, but not all women can take it.
Dr. Pinkerton says some women have medical conditions that can make taking hormone therapy more risky.
So that's an estrogen-sensitive breast or uterine cancer, heart attack, stroke, blood clots, pulmonary embolisms. And, you know, it's really important that women have a discussion with an informed healthcare provider because you want to know what are the benefits and risk for you.
The black box warnings were based on data from studies including the Women's Health Initiative that pointed to cancer and blood clot risks. But the science has evolved a lot over the last 20 years. And importantly, there's been a shift in how estrogen is administered and new formulations making it lower risk. For instance, many women are now prescribed patches instead of pills.
Now we know that oral therapy does slightly increase the risk of blood clots and stroke. So if you have women who have risk factors or are older, you want to think about doing transdermal therapy.
Transdermal patches, gels, or rings can deliver estrogen directly through the skin, which may lower the risk of clots. And instead of giving women synthetic progestin, as was given in the Women's Health Initiative study and was linked to an increased breast cancer risk, doctors can now prescribe alternatives, such as micronized progesterone, which is identical to what's produced naturally in the body and has fewer side effects. Now, many menopause experts support the FDA's decision to remove warning labels from some estrogen products, but they don't all carry the same risks, explains Dr. Monica Christmas of the University of Chicago. She says many women benefit from estrogen creams for painful sex, bladder control, and reduced risk of urinary tract infections.
I think most would agree that with local low-dose vaginal estrogen therapy that the risk are negligible for most people. And so I do think for the local vaginal estrogen, it is reasonable to remove that black box warning. I don't think we need to scare people unnecessarily.
However, for higher dose systemic estrogen therapy, including estrogen pills, Christmas and other menopause experts are more equivocal about removing the warnings.
One of the nice things about the black box warning is that it does provide that pause. It allows patients to want to ask their healthcare provider what the black box warning means, what potential risks there may be, and what the safety is.
Women should not have to suffer with menopause symptoms, and Christmas says there are many options, including non-hormonal alternatives. She recommends talking to healthcare providers to help decide what's best. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You're listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered from National Public Radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also sample our album of the week. Coming up at 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Then at 10 o'clock tonight, a special Veterans Day special, Conversations from Veterans from WHYY. That's followed by Veterans Appreciation Music with Paul Ingalls at 11 o'clock tonight. If you are a veteran, thank you so much for your service. Support for KAXE comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information at northhomes.org. We also thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, providing the energy to help power ideas and strengthen rural development throughout northern Minnesota. More at lakecountrypower.coop. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Rife Dance presents a special Nutcracker story time at the Grand Rapids Area Library this Friday at 10:30. A craft time will follow the story, and there will be photo opportunities with the Rat Queen and the Nutcracker. And the Bemidji Senior Center has free hearing screenings provided by the Lions Club this Friday, 10 a.m. No appointments are needed. Let us know what's happening in your community. You can send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. You can also find Events Up North, an online event calendar, at our website every week. It's kaxc.org. There is more ahead from All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The new president of Ireland was sworn in today. It is a largely ceremonial role, but the landslide victory of Catherine Connolly, a far-left, anti-establishment figure, has shaken up Irish politics. In her inaugural address, she vowed to be a steady hand as well as a catalyst for change. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab has this profile.
When Ireland's new president made her victory speech at Dublin Castle, she took to the stage and didn't speak in English.
The Gathine Satir. Gathine.
She began that speech in Irish, an indigenous language that many politicians don't speak fluently. Even in Irish politics, it was an unusual way to start a speech by an unusual candidate. Gary Murphy, professor of politics at Dublin City University, says Connolly is one of Ireland's most left-wing politicians.
Everything in her background suggests radicalism. She's far to the left of pretty much every party.
Connolly says her upbringing in Galway on the west coast of Ireland shaped her views. One of 14 children, her mother died when she was 9, and she was raised by her father, a builder. Here she is telling BBC Radio about her early life.
I watched my father, the most honest man, work every single week on our behalf to bring us up.
She went on to be a psychologist, then a lawyer. She was in her 40s when she went into politics, first as part of Ireland's centre-left Labour Party and then as an independent. In Ireland's Parliament, she spoke out about the country's housing crisis and inequality. Her focus on these issues in her presidential campaign enthused younger voters, says Una Mullally, columnist at the Irish Times.
She was kind of speaking to a lot of younger people in particular who want the country to be different in terms of progressive values, better infrastructure to address the housing crisis.
She was outspoken about global issues too, Mullally says, and in particular her support for Palestinians.
She was also a critic of militarisation across Europe and then very, very critical of what she would have characterised as genocide in Gaza. And because the Palestine movement is so large in Ireland, that was something that she really centred at the outset of her campaign.
But some of her comments have raised eyebrows. She has accused NATO, of which Ireland is not a member, of warmongering, and also said Hamas is part of the fabric of the Palestinian people. In a BBC interview, she explained why she thought Ireland's own history of British occupation was behind support for the Palestinian cause.
Ireland has a unique history. We're a post-colonial country. We had a famine. That's still very much alive in our mind and in our DNA. And I think we need to use that to promote peace in the world.
Aoife Moore advised Connolly on her press strategy.
Catherine was quite unknown, but the more people learned about her in a very unlikely way, the more they liked her.
She says Connolly, who barely uses social media herself, became an unlikely star on TikTok. A video of her juggling a soccer ball on her knees with children in a Dublin playground went viral. And a bit like Zoran Mamdani across the Atlantic, her branding tapped into cultural trends, says Mullally.
I think that they also, either by accident or design, some inspiration from Zora Mamdani's campaign, because her brand identity was inspired by traditional Irish shopfront signage whereas Mamdani's obviously comes from the bodega signage aesthetic in New York City.
While the role of president is largely ceremonial, Connolly's win is a success for the coalition of left-wing parties who backed her. That includes Sinn Féin, a nationalist party with past links to Irish Republican militants, says Moore.
I think the big winner out of the presidential campaign is going to be Sinn Féin. Now that the left wing has shown itself and the country that it can band together to elect someone that the country wants.
Connolly's decisive win over the establishment candidate is a rebuke by voters to the two traditional parties who, between them, have ruled Ireland for over 100 years. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
Bubble, bubble, pasta pot, boil me some pasta, nice and hot. Parents and teachers have been reading those words out loud for 50 years now. That is right, Stregonona, the pasta witch from children's literature, turns 50. The picture books have been both beloved and banned. Half a century later, the Italian grandmother still finds new audiences, even on TikTok. Alex V. Cipolli, with member station Minnesota Public Radio, explores why Stregonona endures.
In her office overlooking the Mississippi River, curator Lisa von Drasek begins to read.
In Calabria, a long time ago, there lived an old lady everyone called Stregonona, which meant Grandma Witch.
Von Drasek is the curator of the Curlin Collection of Children's Literature at the University of Minnesota. She flips to the title page. There's a doodle of Stregonona drawn in pen by the author Tommy DePaola.
For the Curlin Collection, with love and three kisses.
The East Coast author, who died in 2020, wrote more than 250 books. He gave the university dozens of manuscripts and illustrations, including the original watercolors for Stregonona.
This is pen and ink and watercolor. You see? Look at her dancing. So that's the title page.
DePaola was connected to Minnesota through Karen Nelson Hoyle. Nelson Hoyle was the previous children's literature curator and a mentor to DePaola. Von Drasek, who was also friends with DePaola, explains he wanted people of all ages to have access to his work.
And he wanted us to have these because we're open access. I have classes with 8-year-olds. I have classes with graduate students. And all of them have the opportunity to hold these materials in their hands and say, oh, a human being did this.
Von Drasek says that despite the book's gentle nature, it's been the target of book bans because it portrays witches in a positive light. Even so, DePaola won a Caldecott Honor Award, given by the American Library Association annually for distinguished children's picture books. In an interview with the City University of New York, DePaola said Stregonona was his favorite character he ever created.
She's a charming character, and I'm even amazed by her. She strikes a chord in everyone. You know, you don't have to be Italian to love Stregonona.
With magic powers and a pasta pot, Stregonona heals and feeds her little Italian village. When her young apprentice, Big Anthony, secretly tries to use her spell, the town is overcome with spaghetti. The village people call for corporal punishment, but Stregonona remains patient and kind.
But there are consequences. Here's a fork, Big Anthony.
And she tells him to eat all the pasta. Von Drasek says DePaola was similar to Stregonona.
I never saw him impatient with a child, with a parent. He exuded kindness.
Von Drasek says Stregonona is a poignant character because she's a resourceful, wise woman, a witch.
When we think of Stregonona, Tommy DePaola's illustrations are all so sweet and gentle, and it's not scary at all.
Half a century later, new audiences have found Stregonona. She's even become a TikTok trend.
Why Stregonona? It's a picture book that's like a hug.
For NPR News, I'm Alex V. Cipolli in Minneapolis.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. From The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9 FM. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for your support. Weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 20s, breezy west winds, and tomorrow mostly sunny with highs in the low 40s and breezy west wind continues. Support comes from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities